Welcome to season 4 of the ICA podcast, where we interview African artists and curators who perform and curate live interdisciplinary works. This is an initiative created by the Institute for Creative Arts, which is based at the University of Cape Town in South Africa. Our fifth episode features an interview with writer and teacher Aika Swai about her performance lecture titled Uncharted Dialogue, which she presented at the ICA Scholars Showcase last year. Here she speaks about her methods of teaching and her approach to what she calls languaging in her work, as well as the value of African languages as inherent knowledge. This season is produced by myself, Atiya Khan, with interviews done by Nkopoleng Moloi.
You are currently working on your PhD, so maybe take us through the journey that led you to where you are now.
It probably started in my childhood, you know, growing up in the presence of multiple languages, but also a very dynamic way of operating across languages. So if one is exposed to that from a really early time, there's this thing that I took for granted until I left home to go study in the US, and that is how much we love to philosophize about language. So I can just remember so many conversations where there is a sort of a small group of, let's say, relatives, uncles, cousins, debating about what's the best way to say something, or debating about where a certain word comes from, or how a word breaks down in smaller parts and how each part has its own power. So that whole phenomenon, that whole practice of thinking about language in everyday conversations, the most mundane moments, that's something I took for granted until I, you know, reached the university age and studied comparative literature, and then thought about what I now call languaging practices that I grew up around. So that is to answer the question about the journey of the PhD, that's how I would answer it. But this practice of celebrating language and like really embedding it almost automatically in the most, like I said, ordinary conversations, a sort of awareness and metacognitive appreciation of how language works and where language comes from. And now, as you correctly pointed out, I'm in the middle of my PhD at UCT, and the topic has now refined to looking at how do these languaging practices that are actually really ancient, if we really brought them forward to how we read and how we teach our students to read, we might get some good answers and hints and pieces of advice with regards to the decolonial project. And so what I'm finding is that this ancient practice of appreciating language together and reflecting on language, if we actually applied that to how we read literature and how we put literature in conversation with other literature, which is another way of reading literature, then we get something really interesting.
So this question of teaching feels like it's right at the center. So I guess what I'm interested in, like, your thoughts around what teaching is and what it does and why you do it personally.
All right. So I was one of those children that loved to play school. So I'm the firstborn in my family, and my poor little siblings and cousins had to play with, I mean, as early as I can remember, whether it was me being the teacher in person and embodied, or whether it was us playing with dolls or little figures to imitate a classroom. So I always knew that I wanted to be a teacher, and then I never really considered anything else, to be honest, because I've been so happy in that profession. I think there's nothing that excites me more than reform, transform, whatever word suits best here, this process of improving our curriculum and our instructional practices. It's time to speak across language barriers and see what new knowledge gets generated in that process of crossing. It's vast, and for us in Africa, it's a really exciting time to be in these classrooms where we get to dethrone English. And that does not mean that we diminish or do anything negative to English. We're just taking it off its pedestal. And we're learning to look at it as a language with enormous possibilities. And, it makes the whole conversation that we're having right now possible. But the more we become aware of the limitations that we as African peoples, for example, face when we're trying to express African realities, the more we become aware of those limitations, the more we are helping our intellectual heritage grow and a vocabulary that is adequate for the task. So it's not just a deconstructive project I'm proposing here. I think every time we look at a word like tribe and we look at a word like native or indigenous, and when we realize, whoa, we would never say it like this in our mother tongues, in our home languages, then, what would we say? I love the words we have for the different statuses of family members, for example. You know, you can't have an uncle in Swahili. You either have a large father or a small father.
I love that.
So, you know, it's such an important understanding. So we shouldn't just settle for words like uncle and aunt. We should fully use uncle and aunt when we speak English, yes, but we should understand that we come from cultures that have words and realities for which English falls short.
Maybe then we can ground ourselves into the work by painting a picture for the listener around the performance work, Uncharted Dialogues. Can you take us through that work?
So Uncharted Dialogues is quite old because it is based on a subsection of my first chapter. And so I started writing my first chapter maybe 3 years ago now, just before the COVID pandemic. So what happens is that I introduce the performance lecture, and I always do that, by the way. I don't know if I'm giving away my secret ingredient or one of them, but I always transition from being in the audience to being on stage with an introduction. But so I stand in front of two chairs. Very simple, between the two chairs is a table with two piles of books. Sometimes maybe you can add a glass of water to sort of imitate a very traditional interview space, something that we have become accustomed to, you know, from television and numerous other settings where that's the Q&A format, two chairs in a sort of cozy arrangement and proximity to each other. And then after introducing my rationale or my intentions behind the piece, then I sit down on one of the chairs and I begin this lecture. This particular performance lecture works really well with the script in hand. So that allows me to constantly play around with modes of reading and modes of interrupting myself when I am reading. Yeah, so I do that throughout this performance lecture. I switch between the two chairs, not so much to represent two different characters or two different perspectives, but to show and externalize academic ways of thinking, dialoguing, and engaging each other's ideas. The lecture is about this challenge of how to put American literature in conversation with African literature. and how to deconstruct that word American literature from the get-go and sort of void it of its assumption that American literature consists, let's say, of white American or Black American authors primarily, and to really get the audience then to constantly reflect how have they been socialized to think of American literature, and is there any way or history of being encouraged to envision an American Indian author, meaning an author coming from the group of people or the groups of people that have occupied and lived and taken care of what we now call the Americas long, long, long before Europeans even thought about setting sail. The lecture is basically an externalized academic dialogue about the difficulty of overcoming these barriers that have really established themselves through the historical encounter with empire. This idea that we as Africans have no blueprint per se in how to directly engage with American Indian thinkers and literatures. We would sooner be encouraged to engage with French, German, English writing and authors. So it's hard to summarize all the little micro moves, as I call it. These are all pedagogically sequenced movements through, it's a curation of understandings that I would like to the students to experience, like a sort of as if you're going through an intellectual gallery walk. And by the end of the performance lecture, the Uncharted Dialogue, I basically conclude by saying, you know, we have to figure out how to engage and dialogue despite beyond the history of brutality that somehow, you know, connects us. That's in a way, that's how we met, even though there's of course a pre-colonial encounter between Africa and Americas as well. But in our popular culture, in our current curricula, we have to admit in Africa, we have been complicit in the erasure of the American Indian. So an understanding that complicity then results in a call for action, of course, and that's how we end the performance lecture then, modeling what it would mean, what it might look like, what might it sound like to put the two piles of books in conversation. So it's very improvised, actually. I pick up a book from each pile and I sort of very quickly show or imply to the audience why it would be so fascinating to read these two books in parallel to each other and have them inform each other. And then I open the mic or the floor to anyone in the audience to come up, because after all there are two chairs and now I stop moving between chairs, and then if I'm lucky people volunteer and they're you know one after the other will join me to sort of continue the modeling of this externalized thinking process.
This might be a bit of an unfair question. if you are just naturally funny, maybe this is an unfair question. But what I was going to say was that it felt to me like you're also using humor as a mode or a strategy somehow. Not that you like writing comedy, but there were ways in which you would phrase something like very simply and it would just be like, yeah, quite funny. So I wanted to ask you about that, like how much of that is a strategy and like really deliberate, and how you think through that.
Oh, humor. Yeah, I love, like most people, I love to laugh. I love it when students get to laugh in a classroom, especially what folks are going through, you know, it's hard enough. And then if you do want to do this hard work of learning and studying the literatures written by people who were under so much attack and who continue to be under so much oppression and attack, then you can get very, very fatigued. You know, compassion fatigue is real. There is a burnout, an empathy burnout that can happen. And the numbing that entails is actually quite scary to me. It's one of the scariest things. And so it is very, very important to build in moments of stress release, moments of comic relief, moments of, you know, little moments of celebrating how amazing we are as a human people, where the majority of us are peace loving peoples who are not interested at all in oppressing each other. And so to sort of step into the reality of, okay, we are the majority, you know, we who want this thing to work out, this whole thing with the planet, we're gonna be all right. We need to budget our energy, and we need to really sort of conserve energy where we can, because the struggle out there is really, really hard. So the genre in literature that I admire most is satire. And I'm realizing that, you know, why I admire it so much is I consider it to be the hardest one to write. I find, like, the honesty you have to have when you write a memoir or autobiography is also really hard. But the wit and just that clever humor you have to have if you want to pull off successful satire, that to me is a really refined level of wisdom that I aspire towards. And so I think a lot of the humor that I embed in my performance lectures is I think it's a satirical kind of humor. It's the humorous moment comes out of putting the learner or audience in a position of considering how abnormal and unfamiliar and strange our you know, our day-to-day is, if we choose to look at it as something strange. I think that is something where if we can learn to sort of laugh at ourselves a little bit and not take everything so personal right away. So especially when we talk about race, I find myself really having to balance the seriousness with which the magnitude of the problem needs to be addressed, and then also creating moments where we can breathe and go somewhere else with our energy.
Okay, so I'm gonna ask you one final question, and then I think we can close, just so that I'm not selfish with your time. But the question is, why language matters? You know, what is at stake in terms of how we define things? Why does it matter?
Oh, yeah. I mean, let's play with the word matter and look at it as a verb, which is how you asked it. And then let's look at it as the noun, you know, what is matter? And yeah, language matters in both ways, because earlier when we said language structures thought, what we're saying there is that language has a direct impact on our entire neurological being. I mean, our entire being. It is absolutely critical that we understand the word, the sound, the power, and that words have power. And where do we know this from? We know this from our African intellectual heritage, where in multiple regions all over the continent, we get these philosophies around language and how words have power. Words have something that loosely translates to the word spirit in English. And we have this again in the Caribbean. And I think Rastafarian thinkers have articulated it with such lovely precision, this entire philosophy around word, sound, power. It needs to be taken very, very seriously. And unfortunately, as you know, globally, people start taking things seriously on the mainstream level when Western science proves it. So it turns out that there's plenty of proof now that shows how we react to language, how we react to words, how words like swear words, like racial slurs, for example, how such words actually have the power to plunge us into depression, into existential crisis. This is real. This is not just people throwing around a couple of mean words and then, you know, suggesting I can just bounce back after I've been called the N-word or the K-word. No. No, the only reason why I'm sanitizing those words is because this is a recording and it must exist in the public sphere, and I don't want to inflict more violence and injury out there by saying those full words. But we have to be very sincere. These words have power and they are still in use. And we have a power dynamic with the English-speaking word that makes it so that, you know, America is a hegemonic force in this regard. What America says about us in Africa has a currency that, yeah, is hard to mess with. So if we as Africa and African people, if we get called shithole countries, for example, by the president of the United States, then no, we can't just brush that off as, oh, this was just another rude moment in this rude man's life. This is a semantic problem, and it's a semantic declaration of war. So we have to be word warriors. We have to be wordsmiths again. We have to language as a verb. Language is what helps us externalize all that is interior. So the best and quickest way to, you know, work with trauma is to externalize it. Thus, we write. Thus we emit, thus we express. Language is our life force.
The ICA podcast is a project produced by the Institute for Creative Arts at the University of Cape Town, based in South Africa. Thank you for listening.